Now, for those who've been coming every week or haven't been coming every week, let's just review what we've looked at so far. The first week we looked at the idea of the Mashiach as it appears in Tanakh, and in particular through the explanation of Maimonides. The second week we went through a group of several false messiahs in history from about the 5th century till about the 16th century. And the truth is, on that second night we really covered all the ground, just about. I mean, there is a little more you could uncover about those people, but frankly, we did a pretty good job at learning, at studying their stories and the events surrounding their strange careers. When it came to Shabtai Tzvi last week, so really Shabtai Tzvi, because of the wealth of information, we could spend years, and scholars are doing that right now. I mean, Shabtai Tzvi is a subject that we could go on and on and on about. And last week we pretty much went through the basic outline, and what we saw was that a misuse and a misunderstanding of very potent and authentic Jewish ideas were to a certain extent misunderstood, and therefore that led to a series of catastrophes. Throughout the Jewish world, there was a mass movement of people believing in Shabtai Tzvi in all the Jewish communities. And this led to people giving up their property, people antagonizing their neighbors who they thought they would soon lord over because of the Messianic age. And in the aftermath of this disaster, Jewish mysticism became sort of a taboo, dirty subject for quite a long time, for somewhere around a century. And people who felt that there was beauty and truth in it were persecuted, whether or not they had any Shabbatean leanings. In other words, there were genuinely some people who we know still believed that were followers of Shabtai Tzvi and his messianic mission. And we could argue whether the persecution of those people was appropriate, but there were definitely other people caught in the crossfire. People like Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, whose works now are looked at in every yeshiva in the world. There's no yeshiva in the world where the students don't study Mesilat Yesharim of the Ramchal. But at his time, he was hounded because of his Kabbalistic approach to life and his mystical leanings and teachings. It was finally redeemed by the Baal Shem Tov, who made the mystical approach to Judaism. He took the taboo away from the mystical approach to Judaism. Now, as we know, of course, this was not a simple process. And we ended last week talking about his battle against Jacob Frank, one of the final Sabbatean leaders. But we know, of course, that the Baal Shem Tov's career was incredibly controversial. And we ended last week talking about how he opposed that. And basically what the Hasidic movement did was they took many of the aspects of the Sabbatean model of a miraculous being who was an interface between man and God and therefore should be revered and followed and obeyed and seen as incredibly worldly and knowledgeable in many ways. But they did that without the messianic pretensions. And when we ended last week, I said, it's obvious what happened in the 20th century, or at the end of the 20th century, when we had a movement where just the slightest nudge, and if that messianic layer is painted back on, now we end up with the disturbances we have in Chabad. And I really wasn't going to talk that much about Lubavitch, but several people came to me with questions, so I guess I don't have that much more to say about it. I think there's a very good book by David Berger, who has taken it upon himself to become the point man on this issue. It's called The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. David Berger is a scholar, but really a scholar, and of a scholarly temperament. He's a very, you know, quiet, I would even say bookish gentleman, who became very passionate over this issue. His field of study happens to be the medieval Christian-Jewish debates.
And so this line, his field of study is exactly what the medieval rabbis explained to the Christians, the lines we don't cross, the lines that separate us from you. And pretty much the baseline, bottom line is, somebody who dies is not the Messiah. There's no second coming in Judaism. And that's on the other side of the line. So when he saw what was going on in Chabad, he became incensed and terrified. And in particular, he's disturbed by the lack of reaction in the rest of the Orthodox world, that people aren't taking a stand against it. So let me just take a few minutes, which is more than I really wanted to, on this subject. I think that it happens to be, by the way, just by a quirk of luck, just by the way my books piled up at home in the order that I put them. It was not intentional. But after I finished reading Gershon Scholem's Shabtai Tzvi book, the next book on my pile was David Berger's The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. And the parallels are obvious. Even if I had read it later, reading it afterwards made it a very disturbing experience. But the parallels are obvious. There's no question that going on right now in some circles in Chabad is a sort of neo-Sabbatean movement. It's really identical in many ways. In philosophical formulations, they're coming up with very similar language to what Nathan of Gaza came up with. And it's very similar in the way that historically the way Sabbateans would behave and the way certain Lubavitch people are behaving. There are very strong parallels and similarities. Certain language cues that, and this Berger doesn't even point out, but in his book when he's describing the way they carry themselves and talk about things, that they use certain words that if you're on the inside you know what they mean, if you're on the outside they sound more kosher. So he exposes that, and I had just seen that in the Sabbatean movement. So in my mind, there's really no question that in the Chabad world, there is a branch of neo-Sabbateanism. Why is that? Well, I think the reason is the same as the reason we had Sabbateanism. In other words, here was a movement of people who, again, were not convinced that the Messiah was coming. They were convinced that the Messiah had arrived. And that being the case, it becomes very difficult to readjust to a change in the story. What do you do about that? And so, apparently, it's human nature. These things have to be human nature. The Sabbatean movement was too widespread. These stories about Nathan of Gaza being able to read people's souls, these stories about miracles that people saw Shabtai Tzvi perform, that people brought as proof and accepted as proof, means that to a certain extent, and this is not a surprise, I don't think, we can convince ourselves of a lot. And so that's going on now in Chabad. And the example really in the Sabbatean movement that I didn't really emphasize last week was that after the apostasy of Shabtai Tzvi, when he converted to Islam, Nathan of Gaza found out in November of 1666. Right? Am I getting that mixed up? I never give, in my Jewish history test, I hardly ever give any dates because I get them all mixed up in my head. It's not really fair for me to test the kids on it. But in November, he heard the news and put out the announcement that there's a great mystery and everybody should wait. His proclamation that this was a form of Shabtai Tzvi descending into the broken vessels of the world to repair them didn't come till April. That means December, January, February, March, into April, Nathan of Gaza had nothing to say about the apostasy of Shabtai Tzvi. Now, we don't have any journals or memoirs that he wrote that explain to us what was going on in his head during these months. But what could it have been? Nathan of Gaza's reputation was to a large extent why Shabtai Tzvi became accepted. Why was this news at all received as valid? Well, Scholem argues that for one, it came from Eretz Yisrael. So that gave it automatically a stamp of authenticity. Number two was the point that we've made again and again, that this mystical world outlook that everybody had become accustomed to justified such an approach. But perhaps equally important was Nathan of Gaza was a revered, although he was very young, he was a revered rabbinic figure. And he was an authentic rabbinic figure. So when he said, this is the Messiah, people took it at face value. His reputation was largely what sold the movement. What was he doing in December, January, February, March? What was he doing? There's only one possible thing he could have been doing that I can imagine. He was struggling with his knowledge that this was the Messiah and the fact that this man had converted to Islam, which is about the least messianic behavior you can think of. And it took him months. This is a man who watched Shabtai Tzvi eat treif and make a bracha on it. This was a man who knew that Shabtai Tzvi was married to a woman of whatever you want to make up your own euphemism. Right? This is a man who knew about all the bizarre behavior of Shabtai Tzvi. But this must have crossed the line for him. And he couldn't reconcile it. It wasn't a hard structure to reconcile. Once you explain that eating chazer schmaltz is part of your way of redeeming the nitzotzot, so embracing Islam is embracing the nitzotzot. But there was a qualitative difference to him. There must have been. And he didn't know how to wrap his head around it. And he finally went along with the side of sinking into it. I'm just going to go with it. It has to be. He was so convinced that this was the Messiah that he continued to go with it. And then by the time Shabtai Tzvi died, so that was much easier for him. That he right away. Oh, whatever that means, I'm not worried about it, he's still the Messiah. Well, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe was sick, the Lubavitch world was sure, and if you talk to people, they were sure it was some sort of, you know, oh, he's stroking out. We'll see. We'll see. They were sure. And after his death, there's the disbelief, and then what? So now what do you do with that? What does a human being do with that? You're stuck in the position of Nathan of Gaza, of saying, I'm sure I'm right, but here's some whopping evidence against me. So many people took the Nathan of Gaza step and said, well, obviously he's either not dead, or he's going to come back from the dead, or the thing that died wasn't him anymore, he became some celestial being. These things are all in print. And then there's another group that said, well, I can't take that step. I don't know. I'm sure there are people in Chabad who say, for sure this is nuts. But I will say this, and here's David Berger's point. I don't know if David Berger is right or wrong. David Berger very strongly feels that the reason Sabbateanism failed was because there was a forceful opposition from the rest of the Orthodox world. That's his argument. And the fact is that he feels that the healthiest thing when you have a philosophy that crosses the line is that a schism must develop between that group and the rest of Orthodox Judaism. I honestly don't know if he's right or wrong. We live in a different age. You know, they say generals are always fighting the last war. I don't know if the 17th and 18th century dynamic applies in a 21st century world. I don't know that the Chabad subgroup, which has become a neo-Sabbatean movement, is parallel to the global scape of the Shabtai Tzvi movement, which Jews in every community had adopted. Here you have a subgroup of a subgroup within Judaism. I honestly don't know if David Berger is right or wrong and that we need to combat this movement. I will say this, though. It troubles me deeply that there isn't a schism within Chabad. In other words, the RCA finally, after tremendous pressure from David Berger, put out a statement saying belief in a dead Messiah is not within the bounds of Orthodox Judaism. That's the only rabbinic organization that I know of up until now that has done so. The Aguda hasn't. No other organization has taken a stand against them. And it's not like the Aguda is really very shy about condemning Jewish movements they find problematic. This one, we can come up with our own theories and reasons why they're having difficulty. They don't. And again, agree with David Berger that that's a travesty and a historical disaster, or disagree with David Berger and say the situation's different, the age is different, The proliferation of this movement is different. You can't, that's apples and oranges. But I can't think of why within the Chabad movement there isn't a healthy separation from the non-messianists. And there isn't. The movements are intertwined. In the same building. There was an arrest this year in Brooklyn in Crown Heights because somebody upstairs hung up a memorial plaque for the Rebbe, which of course implies that he's dead. And 7 or 8 people were under arrest for beating that man up. I think it was 5 men and 2 women, if I'm not...
I know you didn't want to go on this, but in hindsight, the Rebbe, as far as I knew, never did anything...
The Rebbe is not Sabtai Tzvi. Sabtai Tzvi is not the Rebbe. Very different.
The Rebbe didn't have a spokesperson
either. Did the Rebbe do anything to actively discourage those who thought that he was a Mashiach?
No.
Here we have a problem. In other words, at what point in the Rebbe, and I don't think there's any way to know this, and this happens, unfortunately, it's a very tragic occurrence in the yeshiva world, still today. Such and such a person said this, such and such a person didn't say this. How do we know? Well, he's infirm, he's elderly, and his spokesman is telling us what he said. It shades of President Wilson. I don't know. At a certain point, we don't know how much is from the person, how much isn't. There's certainly some things that who was the Rebbe before him? His uncle? His father-in-law. And his father-in-law said that people are taking out of context and saying that it predicted this. There's some troubling stuff in the language of Chabad that has been distorted, that maybe you and I wouldn't be comfortable saying. It might have been innocuous at the time. But again, I don't know the history that well, and I don't want to spend too much more time on it. Yeah.
Just one thing that bothers me. If what David Berger says is correct, that presents all kinds of halachic problems with Lubavitch Shtita.
Right.
It presents problems with respect to counting a messianic Jew in a minyan.
There's all sorts of halachic problems with
all kinds of issues.
Right.
And, you know, unfortunately, when you travel around the world, let's say you need a kosher food in Singapore.
We all understand. Schools in small Jewish communities, places to stop around the world. We need rabbinic leadership to at least tell us how to handle that.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Rabbis in France are Lubavitchers.
Well, there was...
Chief Rabbi
in Russia right now, Lubavitch has basically taken over the entire Jewish world there. The chief rabbi, there's now a chief rabbi of Russia. Yeah, assigned by Vladimir Putin as Russia's head of the Jew. Now, I don't know. I'm not the guy who's going to be able to answer those questions for you. Who's also Chabad, but doesn't... I think he is. I'm not getting into Chabad politics.
There's always a void, and I meant that worldwide. I didn't mean it in Russia. There's always a void, so therefore they step in.
Well, you have people frozen where they are. There are rabbis living in, you know, Yanomsville that are stuck where they are because the rabbi put them there, and there's nobody to tell them they can now leave their post. So there's a... Yeah, that's a bad gig. It's a very rough situation. Honestly, I'm not comfortable answering the halakhic questions. I'm not comfortable going into... I don't know the specifics of what the Rebbe said and what the Rebbe didn't say. I'm just making an...
groups have not given a definitive sock because there are many ramifications that they don't want to have to deal with.
Right, but that's, of course, you know, that's about as smart as decision as saying, well, I don't want to worry, I'm a smoker and I don't want to worry about not quitting. Because I mean, that's not a healthy attitude. I will say this, and this I was actually talking about with Andrew this week, I think that Chabad is probably... one of the greatest crowns in the, you know, one of the greatest jewels in the crown of the Hasidic world. Mm-hmm. It was the Chabad. The Baal Shem Tov did many things. In other words, when the Vilna Gaon said, this movement is a disaster, it wasn't just that he was being flinchy because of Sabbateanism. It was because they were doing some weird stuff. And they were rejecting a lot of normative Judaism that really is Judaism. And it was to a large extent the Alter Rebbe, among some others, but he was really one of the leaders who sort of drew the lines very healthily for Hasidut and said, no, no, we embrace, for example, Torah study. Just because it's a populist movement and it's not for an intellectual elite doesn't mean that the masses shouldn't be learning Torah. Of course we embrace the learning of Torah. There was a sense beforehand that Hasidut was against learning Torah. And it was not without basis. And it was, to a large extent, the Alter Rebbe and some others who sort of, you know, there was the Vilna Gaon on one side and the Baal Shem Tov on another, and then you had a thesis and an antithesis. And some of these leaders made a sort of synthesis movement. And right now the Mitnagdish movement is a lot closer to the Hasidic movement, and the Hasidic movement took on many elements of the Mitnagdish movement. And I think Chabad had a very big part in that. So if Chabad now is having this, I also think that Chabad is the one movement that's remaining true to the original principles of the Baal Shem Tov, because the Baal Shem Tov was founding a populist movement. The scholarly elite of, you know, of Europe at that time, who were the rabbinic figures who were experiencing the depths of the religion, it was the Baal Shem Tov who said that this doesn't appeal to the masses. You have people who don't feel they're living a religious life, and we need something that speaks to them. That's what Hasidut is based in. It's a populist movement. It was largely against elitism. And if we look in the Jewish world today, where do we find elitism in the Jewish world today? People who are exclusive and shut others out and say this is for a select few. Unfortunately, it's pervaded the Hasidic world, with one exception: Chabad. Chabad is a movement that embraces Jews of all kinds. And so this, if this isn't fixed, and I have no way to predict the future, this will be, I think, maybe I'm being overly dramatic, but I think it's basically the end of Hasidut, perhaps. Or at least the Hasidut that the Baal Shem Tov began. So it's a disaster. Not of Sabbatean proportions, but it's very sad.
At the time that the Vilna Gaon was fighting against Hasidus, the outside world was, to say the least, very unfriendly to Judaism. Not that they love us now, but they are loving us to the extent that they would more than willingly marry us and have us disappear that way. And so that the outside world is not as frightening and as threatening for the Jews themselves.
Well, it depends where you live, but...
Okay. But the point is that the Vilna Gaon had to worry about, when anybody left Judaism, what was then considered normative Judaism, he didn't bother stopping at Hasidus. You know,
Let's stick to our... Okay, because I have a lot to do and not a lot of time. If it's super duper quick.
Super duper quick. What difference makes me? I understand that Chabad makes a difference between this whole thing. I don't feel any direct threat or impact from what they're doing. For example, to go the way they have on the protest, they have something about Mashiach on them.
Well, it depends. If they're deifying a human being, then they're Ovdei Avodah Zarah, they're idolatrous, and there are serious halakhic implications that kick in. There are absolutely, and I'm not speaking about even all the messianists, but there is absolutely an extreme branch within Chabad now that have deified the Rebbe. Don't kid yourself.
I will fight if I feel it's going to impact me. I'm seeing nothing impact.
Take out David Berger's book. It's available at a bookstore or library near you. The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. I feel bad for him. That's his big seller. All his stuff he wrote on the Christian-Jewish debate, nobody ever reads that. I didn't even read it. I have it. But he's a very nice guy. And if you look on Amazon at the book, you will see reviews by non-Chabad people and Chabad people. And those are in some ways as interesting as reading the book. Okay. I have here some excerpts from what I want to talk about, and again, I don't want to leave this distasteful sense of messianism, and I think that the Rambam, I think hopefully, we've pretty much proven that the Rambam standard of when to identify a Messiah is the healthiest, most useful standard. In other words, in any of the cases that we've studied, if they had applied the Rambam standard, none of that would have happened. There's not a single person we learned about who satisfied the Rambam standard as a probable Messiah, let alone the definite Messiah. So that if the Rambam standard is used, we don't have false messiahs.
Let me ask you a real super duper quick question.
Yeah.
For 500 years or so since we've been going through all these false messiahs, didn't anyone whip out Rambam and say, okay, let's just look at these standards?
Well, that has to do with the halachic uses of the Mishnah Torah and its application in the lives of average people and in rabbis. The Mishnah Torah is an interesting book, but it's not generally used as a book of halachic practice, except for Yemenite Jews. We use Shulchan Aruch, which doesn't deal with subjects like that. There's different historical reasons for that. Okay. Oh, Lord, you're killing me. Yeah. No, you. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi. You mentioned Yemenite Jews.
I do, but completely tangentially.
Well, Rambam had the problem of people forcefully converting to Islam under duress, and he claimed that Islam was not
idolatry.
Did that in some way impact upon Nachum of Azza?
No.
Others? No.
No. The Rambam says you have to die before converting to Islam. He makes that perfectly clear. It's not idolatry, but it ain't Judaism. And if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, convert or die, you say die. He says that quite clearly. But if a person did it, so you should be kind to him and take him back in, he says very kind things to those people. But the line is drawn. He doesn't play around with that. Okay. What we want to look at tonight is, so what do we think? What, as 21st century people, are we supposed to understand about things like the coming of the Messiah, especially if we're taking it from a non-heebie-jeebie approach? As, huh?
22nd.
We're in the 22nd century? We're in the 21st, I think. Yeah. I fell asleep. And I think to an even more bizarre extent, the idea that we haven't brought up yet and discussed at all, the idea of the resurrection of the dead, which we talk about every day, and if there's an idea that seems odd to us in Judaism, that's it. And no one less than Maimonides, super rationalist, no heebie-jeebie guy, it's number 13 on the list of things Jews must believe. So I want to at least address the subject and see if we can have some framework within which to understand these ideas. Now, I've brought to you some of the writings, a selection from Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, and if you were perusing it before we started, I don't know that we even need to read it inside most of it. His idea is very clear. You realize that in the middle of the 19th century, well, let me start again. The diaspora process of the Second Temple period begins to a large extent because of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's decision to surrender Jerusalem to the Romans and say, well, we want to preserve Yavne, the yeshiva. And the yeshiva will become the world of leadership instead of the political leadership. We're going to switch to a scholar-based scholarocracy. I don't know, make up your own word for that. But a nation that are led by religious scholars. Slowly over time, that process that he began really led to, and it's a very gentle slope, led to a sense of ourselves, our own identity as a religion, and a lack of self-awareness of being a nation. Functionally, we really started to think of ourselves as a nation at a certain point. This is clearly sealed by the Enlightenment when people say, well, I can be a Jew as opposed to a Christian, but I'm a Frenchman, or I'm a German, which is clearly a misunderstanding of Jewish nationality. And this became the mass Jewish approach during the Enlightenment. In Eastern Europe, where there was a sense of Jews as a people, but still we saw ourselves basically in religious terms. whether mystical or not, people basically saw their Jewish existence as existing sort of out of history. And so expecting the Messiah meant passively waiting for God to intervene on a sort of Egypt-style redemption. And it was people like Kalischer, and I can't imagine what made him start to think this way, other than the growing nationalist movements around Europe. Europeans began to see their identities not by their religion, but by their nationality, as Germans and Englishmen and Frenchmen and whatever. You have the beginnings of Italy's identification as opposed to separate cities, the Risorgimento, where they began to think of themselves as a nation. The different regions of Germany began to think of themselves as a nation. And so Jews in the 19th century also began to think of themselves as a nation. And of course, this is the beginning of the modern Zionist movement. The first people to articulate Zionist ideas in the 19th century were religious Jews. Now, to our great shame, I think that they were not the leaders of the actual movement. But, at least in the concept, it was people like Kalischer and Yehuda Alkali who were the first people to speak about these ideas. And basically what they said was this. We have to stop thinking about the messianic event as this miraculous, sudden, you know, revolution. We have to think of it as an evolution. And we can start the process. We can bring it about by laying out the conditions for it. By beginning to move to Israel, and by beginning to build it as a community, to create a context within which the Messiah can do his job. We can lay out that context and speed things up. And he says this, and basically what Kalischer argues, you can read it on your own, what Kalischer argues is, this is the way God operates, bless you. This is God basically, that's the way he does things. He leaves a tremendous amount up to humanity. He rarely intervenes. And he allows us to do things this way. So we shouldn't be surprised, and we shouldn't sit around and wait. Alkali, whose work I did not include in the handout, which you can find, Alkali said that the Midrashic idea of Mashiach ben Yosef, as opposed to Mashiach ben David, in the Bible, only Mashiach ben David is referred to. But the rabbis had this idea of a Messiah, the descendant of Joseph. Alkali argued that this idea was just that. An idea. It doesn't refer to an individual. It refers to a process. Who was Yosef? What was Yosef's job among his brothers? Yosef was the mashbir. He was the supplier who created the physical environment that the sons of Jacob could survive. He was the one who provided the physical background for them. So, here comes our latest messianic pretender, Dr. Lautman. Pretender, maybe that's the wrong word. You can talk to Jeffrey afterwards with your Rambam checklist, see what he has to say. Last week it was the Pope, this week it's the Messiah. But what Alkali argued was that this Joseph idea is not that there will be a man who's a descendant of Joseph who will be a pre-Messiah. It's that there will be a period of time where the Jewish nation builds a physical context within which to have a spiritual renaissance. And that process, he says, is the idea of Mashiach ben Yosef. It's not a person. It's a time where before the spiritual rebirth takes place, we set the historical context in place in advance. When Herzl died and Rav Kook eulogized him, he made allusions to the Mashiach ben Yosef. Because Herzl began this process of creating a physical context for this Renaissance to take place in. It's very interesting, by the way, if you look at Yechezkel's famous prophecy of the dry bones, you'll notice that it takes place in two stages. Right? First is flesh on the bones, and then God says, watch as I put flesh on the bones, and he watches. And then God says, now watch as I breathe spirit into them. And so people like Alkali and Kalischer were saying, well, if that's the redemptive process, then that's what we should be looking for. First, a physical renewal without the spiritual renewal. And only when that is in place should we expect this spiritual renewal. And if you look at the Bible, or if you look at the history of the Second Temple period, you will see very long periods of time where the nation was building itself. From the time of Yahushua, through the period of the Shoftim, a fairly anarchic period, to the rise of the kings, until the final pinnacle in the times of David and Shlomo, you have centuries where the people are steeped in all sorts of idolatrous behaviors and there's all sorts of problems. Second Temple as well. And the Second Temple really never reached a healthy... I mean, you want to say the time of Yehuda Maccabee was a brief period of a healthy Jewish society? Perhaps. But nobody along the way said, well, this is a disaster. We're supposed to sit around and wait and do nothing. If we don't have everything at the outset, then we must reject it all. This is not an authentic Jewish idea. And Alcalai and Kalischer were voices in the dark at the time. Most of the Orthodox world, or I don't know about most, but a good chunk of the Orthodox world has still not accepted the ideas of Alcalai and Kalischer. If you want our tapes from last year's series on religious Zionism, I think they're available. You can talk to Vicky. But there's no question that religious Zionism takes a very clear stand that the messianic process is not a sudden miraculous event, but it's a long incremental process that will lead to, well, what? That's what we really, I think, have to talk about. What happens? So let's take a few minutes to look at some of the writings of Rav Kook. And I don't know that he's going to clear up that question right away. I put two pictures just because I found this cool picture of him when he was much younger. You always see pictures of rabbis when they're old, and here's before he went white. I have sympathy for that as I begin to, my own process of getting white. You know. Pre-strimal, yeah. When it's just the cool hat with the brim. So I still don't have my hat with the brim, so it's going to be a long time before I get to my strimal.
We all evolve.
Yeah, that's true. That's it. So I'm getting there. Rav Kook says the redemption continues. The redemption from Egypt and the complete redemption of the future are one unending action. The action of the strong hand and outstretched arm, which began in Egypt and worked through all eventualities. Moshe and Eliyahu are redeemers in a single redemption, the beginner and the ender. The opener and closer together fill the unit. The spirit of Israel hears the sound of the movements, the redemptive actions brought about through all eventualities until the sprouting of redemption will be complete in all its plenitude and goodness. In the thought of Rav Kook, the movement from Galut to Ge'ulah, from exile to redemption, is the story of history. And it's not just the story of the history of our people, it's the history of civilization. It's the story of God's development of the human race. Now, I'm selecting from different places in our road. If you look in our road, you're not going to find this in the same place. But take a look at the next paragraph. Forces from without compelled us to forsake the political arena of the world, but our withdrawal was also motivated by an inward ascent, as if to say that we were awaiting the advent of a happier time, when government could be conducted without ruthlessness and barbarism. That is the day for which we hope. Of course, in order to bring it about, we must awaken all of our potentialities and use all the means that the age may make available to us. Everything evolves by the will of the Creator of all worlds. But the delay is a necessary one, for our soul was disgusted, and by our soul he means the soul of our nation. He sees the nation as having its own corporate identity. Our soul was disgusted with the dreadful sins that go with political rule in evil times. The day has come, it is very near, which, at least at the surface, are contradictory clauses, I think. Either it's come or it's very near. When the world will grow gentler, we can begin to prepare ourselves, for it will soon be possible to conduct a state of our own founded on goodness, wisdom, justice, and the clear light of God. It isn't proper for Jacob to engage in political life at a time when statehood requires bloody ruthlessness and demands a talent for evil. At the beginning of our history, we were granted only a foundation, the minimum that was necessary to establish a nation. After our race was weaned, our political sovereignty was destroyed, and we were dispersed among the peoples and sown in the depths of the soil. This is a very big picture view of history and the Jewish people's place in it. What he's arguing is that in antiquity, the Jewish people couldn't function by the ultimate enlightened principles of the Torah. They had to play ball in the region and the historical period that they lived. And so, our national ascension of a fulfilled nation is waiting for the modern era when the world functions in an ethical way. Now, let's put Rav Kook into his historical context and weigh whether we think he's right or wrong. Rav Kook wrote this at the beginning of the 20th century. He wrote this before World War I. There was a very powerful sense at the beginning of the 20th century that history had turned a corner. And that the ages of barbarism, of national warfare, were coming to a close. And these little blips that they would see along the way, they sort of dismissed. World War I was a tremendous shock to people who felt this particular zeitgeist, because it seemed to disprove it. And so you have this sort of, again, this Nathan of Gaza dynamic, but I'm sure I'm right. And so eventually World War I got the famous nickname, the war, to end all wars. That's not just a cute nickname. That's a sense that people had, that this must be, now that we've seen what our modern technology can do, the last vestiges of the age of barbarism must certainly be coming apart. And so we entered into this League of Nations, because now we must be beginning an age where this won't be the way things work anymore. Now, was Rav Kook right or was Rav Kook wrong? Do we live in an age where to run our nation we don't have to resort to bloodshed? Well, to a certain extent he's obviously wrong. We certainly don't run our country without shedding blood. But it's not that simple either. It's actually more complicated than that. Is the world a better place? Well, let's take the existence of something like the United Nations. Now, I'm not naive. I don't think it's an effective organization. If you ask anybody living in Sudan or Uganda right now, they'll pretty much tell you that it doesn't serve its purpose. If you ask anybody living in Israel, they can also tell you that it's definitely not serving its purpose. But what about the idea of it? If I went back into history 500 years, or 200 years, or 100 years, and I told people that there would be an international organization where nations would have a body where they sat together to work out problems with the goal of not resorting to violence anymore. Well, that would be absurd. You can't imagine something like that in a context before the 20th century. When you had conquerors in the past, when you had 20th century was the century of genocide. The very word and the existence of such a thing becomes invented in the 20th century. Let's take Adolf Hitler, clearly the greatest criminal possibly in history, certainly of the 20th century. I don't know, I guess he and Stalin would have to maybe fight it out, but let's give it to Hitler for now. Well, you realize that when Hitler invaded countries, he had to pretend that they had started with him. Here's what a bizarre thing that is in the sense of history. Do you think Alexander the Great claimed that Persia started? Do you think that Genghis Khan had to say, what's China doing? Hitler lived in an age where even the most evil man had to at least pretend that he wasn't evil, because he couldn't function in the world unless he tried to, at least at a ridiculous superficial level, cover up his schemes. The 20th century, while having the greatest horrors in human history, is, I think Rav Kook is right. There is a quantum shift in the 20th century, a different attitude. Israel, which of course does resort to bloodshed, brings this idea into modern combat of purity of arms. And now other countries are beginning to use it. Even the United States, which has waged some pretty barbarous wars in the 20th century and committed some pretty horrible atrocities, right now in this war in Iraq, is very careful, when possible, to avoid harming civilians. And in fact, where did they send a team of military strategists to learn how to fight urban warfare without collateral damage? Where did they send people?
To Israel.
They needed to learn that from Israel. How did you do Jenin with so few people getting killed? We don't get it. Explain. And so while Rav Kook perhaps was somewhat hyperbolic, I don't think he was completely off target. Now let's take a look at this process that he's talking about. And I'll tell you something interesting in the thought of Rav Kook. It's a famous thing that Rav Kook was a vegetarian. Well, he wasn't. He was not a vegetarian. He wrote a very interesting thing. Rav Kook wrote that originally the world was supposed to have been vegetarian. God made a deal with Adam. He created certain rules and regulations, but he did not give him permission to kill and eat animals. Rav Kook says that up until the time of Noah, you have this complete moral disaster where everybody becomes, he has to wipe them out. And so God, after Noah, said, this is according to Rav Kook, okay, Noah, according to the rabbis, by the way, the law of being allowed to eat animals if you kill them first comes with Noah. How does Rav Kook explain that? He says, God realized that the moral burden of becoming enlightened to the extent that you wouldn't harm animals and eat them was just too much of a burden, and so God reduced the burden. He said, I'll tell you what, humans, I'll let you eat animals if you do it humanely, but try not to kill each other. How about that? Let's start with that, and let's see where we go. Rav Kook says that this was God's method of focusing humanity's morality on each other. And Rav Kook says at some point after the messianic arrival, when we've perfected human interaction on a moral way, then we will turn back to becoming vegetarians. Because this allowance of hurting animals will no longer be possible because we'll be so enlightened that we won't even want it. Rav Kook says, interestingly, that people who care about animal rights above human rights at this point in history have a serious historical problem. He said that's going to lead to difficulty. Until we perfect the situation of all humans, we shouldn't be that worried about animals yet. First, let's worry about... So there was no ASPCA in the time of Rav Kook. I don't know that he would have been against it. I do think, for instance, you know that one of the first Nuremberg laws forbade shechita, because it was one of the first things that the Germans said Jews can't do is their immoral slaughter of animals because it's unkind. So I think it's that type of misplaced value system that he was talking about. I don't know that he was talking about ASPCA. But what interests me about this is that Rav Kook sees history as this pendulum beginning in Gan Eden, falling to the depths of exile and horror, and then swinging back up, ultimately ending up back in a Gan Eden type of situation. So that at some point we'll return to that. We're now in, trying to unravel the mission God gave Noah. At some point we'll close that deal, and then we'll move on to higher and higher things and keep going. Which means that according to Rav Kook, and this he articulates very clearly, when the Messiah comes, that's when the real work of human civilization begins. We tend to think of, and here he refers to it as a closing, but he means here the closing of a stage of history. The Messiah's arrival is not the end of history. It's, if I had to put it into sort of baseball language, the Messiah's arrival is not the end of the World Series. The Messiah's arrival is opening day. You've gone through all your practice, all your training, all your trades, the rosters are set, and now you go out opening day and you step out onto the plate to get to work. That's where the real work of civilization begins. That's what we keep talking about in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, if you read it, that it's an age where the whole world will be led by the Jewish superpower in Israel to reach this higher good of serving God as a really United Nations. That's why when we say Hallel, when we say Evan Masu Habonim, I Tala Rosh Pinah, this rock that the builder threw away and thought was garbage ends up being the cornerstone. We who've been persecuted and everything that's happened to us ultimately the world comes to realize that the Torah is the key to success on an individual level and on a national level. And at some point, Israel becomes the superpower, it becomes the model, as it already has in some ways. Technologically, morally, it's begun, I think. And that continues. And then there's a tremendous amount to be done. The Messianic era is not the end of history. What it means is, instead of spending time unraveling disasters and horrors of humans killing humans, all humans will be working together for the betterment of all of civilization. That's a little bit hard to imagine. I don't think it's going to happen next week. But that's what the Messianic era is. It really is more similar to what you see in science fiction on shows like Star Trek, where the whole world is, if you've ever seen the show, the whole world is now working together. They've ended war. They've basically ended disease. They've ended poverty. And they are, as a civilization, pursuing knowledge and growth and making everything better. That's the Messianic era. It's not an ending. Rav Kook says, for instance, in the Talmud they argue, will there be mitzvot in the age of the Messiah or not? Will our holidays exist in the age? Will Pesach still exist? Purim, they all agree, will exist. But Pesach, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, those are on the chopping block. According to some. Rav Kook says, don't view that as an argument between two possibilities. View those things as description of stages. In the short term after the Messiah comes, the Torah will be practiced exactly as it was. But perhaps once we go into the post-Noach stage, and you don't need a chosen people anymore because the whole world serves God, at some point, you know, 5,000 years from now, we may not need a separate chosen people structure with separate laws and holidays. That could be in the far-flung future, thousands of years after the coming of the Messiah. So that Rav Kook definitely sees the pendulum continue to move after the Messianic age. The Messiah comes to usher in these final stages of the pendulum shift, the final part of the arc. How much of the arc will be left after the Messiah comes? I don't know. But it's not an end. It's the beginning of being able to really roll up your sleeves and get to work without all the distractions of people getting in the way. Now, does this do anything to help us understand the idea of the resurrection of the dead? So I think actually it does. And who is this messianic figure, by the way? To me, the analogy to me is, again, if we're not seeing the Messiah as this divine force being magical guy coming and changing everything, but we're seeing this as happening, and the Rambam said that quite clearly, we saw the first week. It's not a miraculous age. It's an age of universal justice. Now, this battle for universal justice has begun. Okay, so Kofi Annan is a schmuck, we know that. But the idea of setting up a stage of universal justice has begun. It's a movement decades in the works, and it is nowhere near completion. But I'll give you an analogy. The civil rights movement in America still isn't really totally finished. But at a certain point, and if you begin it with the earliest abolitionists and follow it through the Civil War and into the 20th century, there then arises Martin Luther King Jr., who didn't start the movement, but at a certain point represented the movement. He became sort of a symbol and a spokesman for it, and sort of was that movement incarnate. And his presence, just by having such a figure who could sort of embody that movement, brought the movement to a new level of success. You have similar examples, certainly in the 20th century. I think Mahatma Gandhi is another good example of somebody who arose at a particular stage of history and sort of captured what that independence movement was about. I don't know that the Rambam is talking about anything particularly different when he talks about the Messiah. In other words, if we're seeing the pre-Messianic stage as being decades in the making, at some point an individual leader in the Jewish world will arise who encapsulates, embodies, and expresses this movement to the rest of us in a way that then becomes perceivable to everyone else outside. At this point, it may seem somewhat unlikely, but it's not far-fetched. Something like that will happen. That's what believing in the Messiah means, according to the Rambam. The minimal belief in Messiah, if you strip away the miracles, is that. That somebody will arise who will encapsulate everything we've been working for the past few decades, and really cross the line and make it succeed. So where does... That's all very natural. Where does resurrection of the dead come in? Now, the Rambam had a very big problem in his career in that he was accused of not believing in the resurrection of the dead. He didn't write about it extensively. He referred to it when he wrote in his teens his commentary on the Mishnah. When the Rambam stated his 13 principles of faith, that was one of them. He didn't come back to it very much. He doesn't really discuss it in the Moreh Nevuchim. He doesn't really discuss it in the Mishnah Torah. And so this accusation arose that Maimonides didn't believe in it. And we have a letter that he wrote defending himself, saying, I absolutely believe in it. The reason I don't talk about it very much is that that is dealing with something utterly miraculous. And so I don't have philosophical language that talks about it. I trust that it's going to happen, that's our tradition, and I accept that tradition. But I have nothing to offer on the subject because I have no insight into it because it's beyond anything natural. Now, scholars afterwards have said, but what he should have done at least, that's a half job. What he should have done is explain how it fits into his system. In other words, if human beings, he says, die, according to Maimonides, there's a spiritual world that we inhabit after death. At some point, and again, if you take Rav Kook's idea that the Messianic era is a long time in history, perhaps thousands of years after the Messiah comes, there'll be this stage where the dead will be resurrected. And then, the Rambam says, then they die again, and they have their fulfillment in the world to come, the spiritual world. And scholars say, trying to reconstruct what was his philosophy of this, to the Rambam, you earn your place in the world to come, in the spiritual world, in the physical world. Now, if you live in the Messianic era, Maimonides says, then you live in a world that's designed, a culture and a society and a civilization designed for you to fulfill your spiritual potential. Now it's your free will to do it or not, but the system is there for you to do it. If you live in the pre-Messianic world, you don't live in such a world. You're persecuted or you're working to make things the best you can. But the Rambam says for most people it's impossible to reach your spiritual potential in a pre-Messianic world. That he does say. So it's not a big jump, say many people on Maimonides, that's what resurrection of the dead is for. It's to give the people who died before the Messiah came their shot to live in this post-Messianic world so that they can fulfill their spiritual potential in an ideal society. And I think that makes sense. But what is it? We can't just close off and say, well, what the Rambam said. It's just nothing we can talk about. But in the 21st century, we have a slightly different perspective than the Rambam. We think of the idea of humanity's progress as a very natural, basic idea. That's what humanity does. It progresses. This century, we have better things than last century. That's actually a pretty modern idea. With the exception of the Jewish idea of the Messiah, which is that civilization will morally improve, most nations didn't necessarily have, nobody on earth had a sense that life on earth would get better other than by tiny increments. If you lived in the 13th century and you had a hearth and you were there, let's say, for the invention of the chimney so that all the smoke in your house went out of your house, you didn't have to live with the smoke of your hearth in your face, that was about the biggest technological revolution you would see in your lifetime. And you would expect your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and your great-great-grandchildren and your great-great-great-grandchildren to basically live the same way you did because you sure as heck lived the way your great and great-great-great-great-grandparents lived too. There was no sense that things were changing. But we live in a totally different world. We live in a world where, as Rav Kook described last week, things that were once purely imaginative become speculation. Things that are purely speculation become scientific fact before our eyes. Right? Sitting in this room, we have an organ transplant doctor, which, how long ago would that have been just unthinkable?
A century,
that's science fiction. Now, it's not daily routine. If you think about the way our grandparents lived, before cars, before telephones, forget air flight.
My mother.
Huh?
My mother was born in here.
Yeah, well, not mine, but my grandmother was. So it's, we have this sense that history is changing at an enormous pace. To the extent that we live in an age where cloning is a theoretical possibility. That we don't bite an eyelash at anymore. You can take a human being who's dead, a little of his genetic information, you can reconstruct him. Maybe he'd be different. If I in some way could take a picture of his synapses and restructure, I could reproduce that human being. Now, I don't know what that means in terms of resurrection of the dead. We, by the way, there are now, in physics, possibilities of beating time. Things like wormholes. That you could possibly, let's say resurrection of the dead simply meant that we could communicate with people in the past. That's a scientific theoretical possibility. You could construct something that I could communicate with people who have died through time. It's scientifically possible. I have no idea, because as Rav Cook said last week, that boundary between reality, speculation, and sheer imagination is getting pushed all the time, and we only expect it to keep getting pushed further. So that the resurrection of the dead is a lot less wacky of an idea today than it was for the Rambam. There are elements of it that we could begin to imagine. Now, we don't have the pieces yet, obviously. But I have no idea. And I really think that this idea is that I think even that, I would argue, will be part of a natural process. That's just where human civilization will get to at a certain point. I think long after the Messiah has come, which unfortunately I don't see that we're necessarily very close to being ready for yet. Yeah. But, look, do we live in a charmed period of history? Absolutely. We talk about in our tefillot, Hitchalta de Geula, Reshit Tzmichat Geulateinu. What does that mean? Does that mean, as some people in some Jewish movements think, that we have begun an inexorable process that cannot be reversed, and we have begun the Messianic era, as people in, let's say, Gush Emunim, or some people in Merkaz Arab are saying? In the Zionistic world, there are people who say, we've begun the Messianic period, no turning back. Well, I think after learning this mini course, I think we have to be a little more skeptical than that. Not more cynical, but more skeptical. There's no end to the folly that a nation can commit. And I think we have to live with a very real sense that the process of Geulah that we've begun can be, God forbid. I think it's possible. But, as Rav Cook says, even those bumps in the road, Rav Cook says, have you ever been to Ein Gedi? And you see the ibexes? Rav Cook says, sometimes you'll see an ibex on the hill over there, and then it disappears, and then a minute later you see it on the next peak. Which meant that it was really there the whole time. You just couldn't see it behind the rocks, and now it just came up and it's visible again. It's traveled in enormous... You thought it disappeared and ran away. The truth is it's been traveling an enormous distance the whole time. You simply weren't perceiving it. Rav Cook says that's what the redemption process is like in some ways. You think sometimes that it's broken or it's not moving. It's always moving. It begins from Egypt and it keeps going. And whether you can see the redemption process in play or not, it's going. And then every once in a while, you get a huge sight of it. Whether that's in 48 or 67, there are moments where you go, oh, there it is. And that has to hold us over, unfortunately, till the next time we see something. But it's coming. I don't know how many peaks or valleys there are, but it's coming. And that's a very important thing to hold on to. And to not, to be skeptical of specific claims, but infused with that sense that this is an inexorable process that history is going through, that God is guiding civilization for that moment. And theoretically, we could live to see it. Yeah.
Just, I mean, you brought up three different areas and talked about the worldwide technological, scientific, whatever, swinging around and growing at a rapid pace. Well, people 50 years ago, it was still growing at a rapid pace at that point, but, you know, there's communication, there's everything, so you can understand where that is going. I mean, 10 days aside, you know, is the resurrection, you know, are those sorts of things going to be possible? Who knows? It may be.
It may end up being miraculous, but it may not be.
Geopolitical, again, the same sort of thing. When you talk about it, there are ideas. You can go back a millennium, and the stories of Arthur trying to put together his round table,
right,
trying to bring everything together. But that's accelerating there. The one point, I guess, in my opinion, that I don't think is accelerating is the spiritual. Because the spiritual has to be the first part of this perfect storm coming in. And if anything, the spiritualism that existed 2 centuries ago or 1 century ago in the reference seems to be declining as we get further and further from Sinai.
Rav Cook disagreed. Rav Cook felt that the current age of atheism and skepticism was actually breathing a breath of fresh air into the religious world, which was steeped in superstition, inconsistency, rationalized iniquity and oppression and violence. And he felt that this stage is an important stage in the maturity of the spiritual world. Right? Oh, I don't know about that. We'll see. I don't know. Think about the ibex. In other words, we could argue whether or not spiritually the world is in a better place than it was 1 century ago. But either way, it's moving. Yeah. Yeah, Sotomayor. Yeah. He's the guy. Yeah. He has as active a role as he did in 1948 or 1967, which is to say a very active role. Absolutely. Not at that stage, no. The Rambam talks about a renewal of prophecy in the Messianic age. But at some point he will become more... But not before the Messianic age. Yes.
Very interesting.
Good. I'm glad.
When you see it in political context and as a natural evolution over however many years,
right,
as opposed to we're in the end of days because it's 6,000 and 5,765.
Correct.
And, you know, it's like, whoa, you know.
That doesn't, right.
But I think you're saying that prior to the second world war, when a rebbe said, this is it, it was it.
That was it.
Even if you didn't study, that was it. But now, young people are studying in tons and gross.
In masses.
And they're really studying and learning what's right and what's wrong.
And that's right. And that's a good thing. I mean,
there's no historical precedent for that.
And that's taken an adjustment to American life, because Orthodox Judaism, frankly, was very slow to adjust to the realities of American life. So,
and everybody knew that America was going to be the worst disaster for Jewish people, and in some ways it is, but in many ways there is this renaissance. And the prophets in the Bible talk about that the age where the sons will teach the parents, which has no historical precedent really, but is common in the 21st century. Good. Good. Marv? Who volunteers?